I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, the rabble-rouser Barrett Brown returns, fourth time on the show, once again discussing his wars with the press, which he has become highly, highly critical of in the past few years. This is a bit of an update of sorts. Barrett was recently banned from Twitter after a spat with the New York Times' David Enrich. So this is the conversation that followed that suspension and that little fight between David Enrich and Barrett Brown. I don't even know if I'd call it a fight, but it sounds like Barrett got under David's skin. So make of that what you will. Barrett, as always, is completely uncensored. I can't necessarily comment myself on all the various people in the world of journalism that he has feuded with, but I think that you'll appreciate this conversation. And I also think press criticism is very, very important. So, without further ado, our latest conversation with Barrett Brown, former anonymous associate, rabble-rouser extraordinaire, and fiery press critic. Welcome back to Parallax Views, the man who has quickly become our favorite rabble-rouser on this program, the one and only Barrett Brown, who just got suspended from Twitter. Barrett, what is going on? What is up with this Twitter suspension?
Well, it's one of the more interesting ones. You know, after a while, when you get suspended from things or banned from things or thrown into jails, both brick and mortar and virtual, you know, it gets kind of mundane. And so you kind of hope that there's going to be some new elements to it to help keep things fresh. In this case, you know, I've been banned from Twitter more than anyone. I have a record on that. And I think I'll keep that record because I was banned several times last year and then restored each time. And then finally banned once more. And then and that one sort of took. And so then I took over the Twitter account for Pursuance Project, a nonprofit I started when I got here, because we're also that's being suspended until such time as I can better defend it from this kind of thing. So it's been using that for the last few months. And then yesterday, after having just the other day, I was commenting on, well, I'm amazed I haven't been banned yet on this account. And what happened was and you've had Val Brokesman on, I think, a few weeks ago, the first time, I think.
I may have some listeners that are unfamiliar with Val. How would you sum up Val? He is a.
I was just citing your ongoing cutting edgeness when it comes to what's going on in the news. You know, you had Val on way before this thing blew up. So Val Brokesmith is a son of a Deutsche Bank executive who committed suicide in 2014. And about a week after this suicide occurred, a bunch of Wall Street Journal reporters started emailing all the members of the family. And Val received an email from this David Enrich, who was at the Wall Street Journal at that time, in which David Enrich was basically asking him to, you know, basically said, hey, I hear your dad was that there were maybe some issues at Deutsche Bank and that he was maybe unhappy or something. If you want to talk? That's where all of this whole inquiry came from. And that has to be kept in mind as we proceed here in this narrative. The very interesting thing that I was not aware of, and I've known Val since 2017 when he first came to me about an iteration of this story. I have been very slow to understand a lot of the aspects of this that have since struck me as quite remarkable. And one of the things I just realized a few days ago was that in the course of trying to get this guy to talk, trying to get Val Brokman to talk, among the emails that were sent to him and the other members of the family, I'm trying to pull up. Let me pull up this. I want to make sure I get the exact words. Here we go. Here it is. David Enrich, again, he's now at the New York Times. He was at Wall Street Journal back then, 2014. Val Brokman wrote this to him in response to an email. I heard you emailed my family. In the meantime, it would be kind if you left my little sisters and mother alone. Everyone is very sad and grieving right now. And to that, four minutes after that, David Enrich at the Wall Street Journal wrote back, it wasn't me who emailed them, but if you are willing to meet next week, I will ask my colleagues to stand down for the time being. Now, I've seen a lot of behind the scenes stuff in the press. I'm not as conversant with the business press usually. I've never seen anything like that, a quid pro quo being proposed whereby we stop harassing your family if you talk to me, which is exactly what this is. And I posted this screenshot the other day on Twitter. And I sent it to the New York Times. This is where David Enrich now is. But I should probably deal with the arching narrative here. For whatever reason, Val, meets with him I guess because he realized he was going to have to. He's got to talk to somebody. No one was going to leave his family alone when there was the heir of something going on at Deutsche Bank, and this was for some reason circulating around these reporters way back then. The two of them worked together for a couple years as Val started to dig into his father's life at Deutsche Bank. I'm always going to mispronounce Deutsche Bank. I don't know. I have no intention of pronouncing it correctly. It's German. Deutsche Bank, whatever. Val taught himself, banking and finance, to learn, go through these documents and learn about what led to his father's suicide, if it was indeed something to do with loans to Trump, which is one of the elements that very early on became evident here, that there was some connection to loans being given to Trump, along with some other perhaps even shadier things. And so over that time, him and David became friends of sort, had a source and journalist relationship in the modern sense, which is to say that they had a number of relationships, there was early on a decision by David Enrich that he could do a book on this. And he proceeded to pursue a book deal and got one. The book was originally called The Banker's Son, and it was going to be about Val, emphasize Val's quest to, make his determinations. And it was going to provide an account of some of the other interesting things that Val did. And Val is very much like me in some ways. He is a fixer, as in, which is what I am now. He is somebody who eventually developed, he realized he was good at leveraging the levers behind the scenes in the media and other things, intelligence community as well, in order to produce outcomes. It's hard to do, and it's easy to get wrapped up in, and it's easy to screw up, which we all do, but he was pretty good at it. And over time, the two pursued film deals based on this book that David Enrich was writing. They pursued a Netflix series. They met with Netflix executives. They went to parties at Al Pacino's. Was it Al Pacino or the other one? I don't know. What are their – doesn't matter.
Robert De Niro.
Robert De Niro's daughter's house, or Al Pacino, I don't know which one. One of those two people that I had a party with. Yeah, but anyway, so the situation, and but at the same time, there was some tension there towards the end, like the last 2018 and 2019, as it started to become clear that the thing was changing, that this is no longer going to be a book that emphasized, primarily the findings, or provided a good account of, what Val had done, and the fact that Val was very much the person that was fueling David Enrich's own rise. Well,
I just want to add really quick, the book that comes out, Dark Towers, much of it is just a sort of sensationalist telling of Val's life after the death of his father. It's very obvious that there's you know, a lot of juicy sort of sensationalism in there for the people who buy books at the airport crowd, getting into his substance abuse problems and his problems dealing with his father's death. And, you know, by doing that, I feel like Enric does a disservice to the information that Val gave him.
Absolutely. And that's the key thing I want to emphasize here is that, and what I told Val myself, I would slit Val's throat or my own throat or your throat if I thought that was what was necessary to accomplish the means that journalism are supposed to accomplish and which they have not in the last 10, 15 years. Because the alternative is more genocide in the Arab world. It's more deterioration here. And it's basically this the alternative of having a press that works and a polity that functions is something so unimaginable that, you know, no whistleblower's life, you know, is of any worth in comparison. Of course, you can also imagine how little I think of someone like David Enric in that context. I mean, I'm someone who's watched, who sat there and let his own mom be prosecuted rather than agree to plead to a precedent setting, you know, criminal indictments that would have allowed the U.S. government to pursue anybody for linking defense. I'm essentially a Bolshevik, you know, in terms of my seriousness about these. So I emphasize that because it's so easy for when I approach the journalists and explain this kind of stuff to them, it's easy for them to say, oh, this is some kind of he said, she said personal dispute. It's not. It's not. I have no concern whatsoever for what happens to any particular person, except to the extent that there's a policy component, because I can't afford to. And also because I know how little the public cares, because I've watched it happen to me and others. And I haven't read this book. What I have read and what, just as you've been struck by how the book does a disservice to the information, I've been struck by this profile piece, and this is really where things ticked off. And I've been following this, as some of my associates have, that I've kind of deal with behind the scenes for a while now. I introduced Val to a bunch of people, having gotten the sense that he was somebody with a lot of information that needed to be gotten to the right places. And this profile piece that occurred, that came out in New York Times, that David Enric wrote, and that was essentially an advertisement for his book, and also seems to have functioned as a sort of alibi and a means of ensuring that Val would never be able to challenge what happened here by ensuring that he is first established as A, unreliable, B, a credit card thief, C, you know, just a bunch of different things. That's what the function of the thing was. There is no other reason to have written this thing in this way. And someone like myself who has, you know, and the article is called Me and My Whistleblower, which to me, just that title, coming from someone at the New York Times, given their history, which is half hidden in terms of how they've used whistleblowers and sources in the modern age, it's something that strikes me, I would say. It gets my attention in a negative way. The article itself, I mean, the first half of it, which is basically the first half of it, you could read without knowing any background here, and any competent person should be able to see that something is wrong. That there is a very odd things being said. For instance, David Enric, you know, writes here in this profile piece that he was sometimes worried that Val was manipulating him towards his dreams of making a Hollywood movie. He had fantasies. That's the word he used. Fantasies about Hollywood. Now, that may very well be true. I don't care, and neither should anyone else, whether or not somebody who was being here degraded and dehumanized and dismissed as a source. What is Hollywood fantasy maybe? Why is that newsworthy? But adding to that, and contributing to how despicable and how indicative this is of the larger problem here that goes well beyond Deutsche Bank, Trump, Russian mafia, finance, blah, blah, and really speaks to a lack of moral substance in anything that touches upon our polity and our civics. Adding to that is the documents that are extensive, very extensive, and very unambiguous, that show that it was David Enric who had Hollywood fantasies, perhaps in addition to Val, but who was the prime motivator for a pursuit of making a movie.
Could you elaborate on that? There was a deal with Netflix, correct?
There was meetings with Netflix, and there's a couple things I can't mention yet because we don't know if he knows that we know, kind of thing. And he's very, David Enrich is very, he's very much watching closely. There was meetings with Netflix. There's pictures of him, you know, that Al Pacino party I'm talking about. That was Val and David Enrich met with some Netflix, two of Netflix executives at this party after they'd already met again previously. There's all these emails in which they meet with other studios. There's being talk about this should be a documentary, should be a series on Netflix, should it be a feature film, blah, blah, blah. And again, there's an inscription that, Enrich writes to Val in his other book that had come out in early 2018, which I have not read. And, you know. Anyway, a description that reads, let me make sure I'm doing this properly. Boom, 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 boom. Looking forward to for Enrich reading. It is. Oh, here we go. Enjoy the book. I can't wait to tell your story in all the cinematic glory that it deserves. Now, looking at things like this, and there's tons of it, things that contradict the assertions made in this article, and then looking at the article, you start to get the sense of what a discrepancy there is between real life and what a set of people who happen to work in a certain sector that happens to be the media, what they decide so often will better serve their own personal interests. Some of these people, the way they operate, I should just go into this because it's so hard for people to understand. It took me a long time. It's still very shocking. It's hard to believe and it's hard to convey because of that. There are a lot of people, there are sectors, of course, that attract a certain kind of personality type. And once that personality type gets into those sectors, they dominate it. And they set the tone for it and it's over. Police is one thing. Politics is another. The press, I don't think was this bad at any point, even in our very, very, you know, uneven history of the press that goes back.
I would say that the press does often, I think what you're getting at, and you don't have to say this, but I will. I mean, I think the press and media work often, it brings in a lot of people that are very egoistic. They want their egos stroked a lot of times, and it gives them a sort of power rush or adrenaline rush to have their headlines in places like the New York Times.
Certainly, but that itself is not even really the problem from my standpoint. That's something that that certainly would not apply. It would certainly apply to me. I see the problem as I think there are some very weird pathologies in play here. And I don't want to go further than that because it's inappropriate for a layman to make a diagnosis, but they do. And people who have dealt with Enrich, other editors, blah, blah, seem to share this idea that he may have, to an unusual extent, what we're talking about here usually, a beyond pragmatic need to say things that are not the case. And I got that impression when I started to interview Enrich. Brings us to this. About a week ago, via Signal, I hit him up, sent him a message, basically showed him a screenshot, just indicating that I had some knowledge about this and that he should thus answer my questions, you know, honestly, or, you know, that it would be in his interest to do so because there was no point in trying to deceive me. And presented him with some screenshots just showing, like, here's the actual reality based on the irrelevant and nonetheless also vastly false reality you put forth about your relationship with your whistleblower. And it very quickly became, I mean, aside from the usual tricks of like answering questions I didn't ask, you know, like in a Donald Rumsfeld kind of way, it became clear that he just couldn't. I mean, at some point I told him, like, remember, dude, I have everything. I literally told him, I have everything. It's the same thing we told Aaron Barr and all these executives, these intelligence contracting firms, this intelligence sector deal they used to go after. It's the same thing we told Aaron Barr the first day after we hacked this company, or the hackers hacked it, and we were going through the emails, when we were questioning the CEOs of HBK or Federal. I remember Sabu who said, Sabu was a hacker, but was a prominent veteran against snitch. You know, remember, we have all your emails. So when we're asking you these questions, remember, we know the answers. Likewise, I tend not to ask questions at all ever unless I know the answer already, because there's no point when you're dealing with these people, whether it be cops or corrupt media or cowardly media, people who are okay with this circumstance, okay with these conditions. There's no point in asking any question whatsoever if you want something other than the answer that they want to give that best serves what they think is their interests. There's just no point to it. It's pointless. It's pointless in talking to these people. It's pointless in treating them as human, from my standpoint, frankly. I wouldn't have said that 2 years ago, 3 years ago even. But it's impossible to escape this conclusion. Anyway, so this interview just proceeded over a couple of days, and I got, you know, because I was involved with other things, and frankly, I was already disgusted with it. But we went back to it. I kept asking more questions, and he gets caught lying quite a bit. And at that point, finally, I mean, after the point in which he should have, he defers to the New York Times spokesperson and says, Daniel Rhodes Ha is the spokesperson for the New York Times. She was aware of the background here. She's expecting to hear from you. Email all questions should go to her. And I told him, well, I mean, you don't even seem to know the background of your own life. So I'll go ahead and reach out to her, sure. And I was not expecting to hear back from her at all. And I was not disappointed. And so 4 days later, after the first emailed her, have not replied back. I've sent her a bunch of questions, screenshots showing, the solidity of my questions, as in the, explain the implications of my questions, which are that they aren't questions. I'm telling you guys what I have. And, I'm also, I think, alluding, trying to convey to them that I used to be a source for the New York Times for a number of people there. And I've been screwed over in ways that are very similar to this. And so there's no point in telling nonsense to me. And I think they got that impression. I think they understood that. And I think between whatever conversations are going on between him and the spokesperson and the lawyers there, they're almost certain that are absolutely involved, probably as of at least 3 days ago, they decided there was no good reason to talk to me, which is exactly right. There is never any good reason to talk to me if someone is as engaged in something that I deem to be amoral, because I'm a crazy little guy about that kind of thing. And I'm very good at this certain kind of this particular thing. I'm not very good at much, but I am very good at sussing out and kind of thick in the tree. So anyway, so that is kind of what brought us here. When it became clear in the last couple of days that was not going to be getting responses back on these questions, I figured I might as well publish the questions so that the public could see what they were and what the New York Times is unable to answer.
And that's when you posted. Did you post on Twitter about this?
On Twitter, yes, because I mean, you know, there's aside from Counterpunch, which I still write for here and there, and aside from books and other things I have going on long term, there's really no place you can do this. I mean, I try to give these stories away oftentimes, but there's very little interest among the press in reporting on the malfeasance of other press, which is one way of putting it. So I published those questions and a couple screenshots of some of these emails that show this massive degree of malfeasance that relates to Deutsche Bank and Trump. And what I haven't got into here, because it's something that others can speak to better than I can, but I should just say briefly, you know, as we said, that the information was done a disservice to. The information was squandered and fractured and presented falsely in the course of David and Rich doing this weird in run around for Netflix series, you know, in order to cut off his you know, no longer useful partner Val. It's very much like the very beginning of that second Batman movie with the Joker and they're robbing the bank and then they keep shooting and then one guy picks a safe and then they shoot him and the next guy does this and then they shoot him. It's that kind of thing. But it's what governs our ability to operate as a nation. And so you can imagine why I'm not quite optimistic about how things will proceed in the next 10, 15 years, because that's how these things are being operated. And so there's one other element to this that I think also better illustrates this problem. But I'm not just talking about the Wall Street Journal, where, you know, where David Enrich first kicked this off and where a lot of his colleagues are still around. It's not just the New York Times. It's not any particular outlet, although there are certain outlets where this kind of thing is more concentrated than others, to put it one way. New Yorker and the New York Times are not even salvageable at this point. They are beyond – they are actually the enemies of the public that Trump has accidentally correctly claimed them to be. They don't know that. They don't think of themselves as that, but that is what they amount to. That's me. Someone who was imprisoned as a journalist, someone who has been rearrested for giving interviews, for me to say that, I hope that it's understood to be something that I've thought about quite a while and would not say had I not concluded it a year ago and then thought it through for the last year. They are the enemies. They are what allow Trump to take power, and then they are what position themselves as the antidote to Trump. None of this is conscious. None of this is intentional. It's just what happens. It's objectively the case. So this last piece of this I should present is that The Guardian, which I used to write for back in the day, wrote for it from prison. The last article I did for The Guardian was in 2013 when I had been in prison for about a year and a half at that point. And Snowden had just come out, and I wrote an article for them explaining I told you so, basically, and reminding the country, for whatever that's worth, which is nothing, that Palantir, Archimedes Global, and these other firms are still out there. They've been caught before, and they've done this, this, and this. Here's what they think. Here's what they say. Here's who their connections are. Here's the threat that represents democracy. And I was put under a gag order for that article, as the DOJ, in open court, the prosecutor referred to that article as, quote, critical of the government, unquote, in the course of pursuing this gag order, which they got, which is what caused me to have to write the Barry Brown Review of Arts and Letters in prison instead of any further articles that hinted upon my case. So it worked out because I got a National Magazine Award for that. But that was the last time I dealt with The Guardian. And the reason I was never in a hurry to, like, when I got out of prison in late 2016, the reason I was never like, hey, Guardian, let me write for you guys again, is because I remember quite well how things were even back then. And anyone could go and look at my old articles or, well, anyway, a number of things and see the corrections that have been made that are demonstrably false, as in corrections that were made after lawyers from military-linked intelligence contracting firms wrote in and complained and just said something and said, like, oh, H.P. Gary Federal and H.P. Gary are not linked, and it says there. You have to correct that, and the correction appears, that kind of thing. A much more indicative and much more despicable correction that was made was to an article that appeared in The Guardian in March 2011, which the title of which was Revealed Social Media – started with Revealed and then went on to describe what they claimed to be revealing, which was the persona management, the online sock puppet mass proliferation program that CENTCOM had caught procuring from these firms, and which, of course, have since reemerged in the form of bots and that kind of thing, which are now – more understood to be a threat. Not only did that article not actually reveal it, it was revealed by a Raw Story editor a month prior and then fleshed out by Anonymous and in particular a couple people I was dealing with over the course of the month. So aside from stealing the story and not acknowledging the very important aspects that were also important, needed to be known and not directing anyone to those things, the article was also corrected to remove references to the possibility that these kinds of things would be used on maybe Facebook and Twitter. You can still see that correction. And it's the most hilarious correction ever made because, of course, whether or not one thinks it's important or matters or blah, blah, whether or not whatever one thinks of what happened, obviously the mainstream of America and the West eventually decided in 2016 that that's exactly what happened, that bots, social media bots on Twitter and Twitter in particular and Facebook as well, are what have contributed to at least confusion. If not any particular scenario that one could point to and prove. And so that, for those reasons and others, I wasn't interested in running for The Guardian. I did so in this case, I got in touch with The Guardian because Val Brooks had already worked out with Luke Harding, longtime Guardian fellow. Luke Harding had offered to provide 500 or 600 words, in which to respond to David Emmerich's book or article, and Val deferred to me on this. And said he'd had me do it. So I got in touch with Luke Harding a few days ago and said, hey, I'm ready to do this article, and here's what's going on. Luke Harding has coronavirus, so he deferred to – he sent me to another editor. I was not familiar with the editor at that point. But editor got right back to me and brought in the investigations editor at The Guardian and talked to him on Signal and presented the information. And it very quickly became clear that even as I could see them reading – everything I was sending him, the read receipts on Signal. One of the great things about Signal is that most people don't think about those read receipts and thus don't realize that you can thus prove that a person has seen something that they might not want to see. It very quickly became clear that no response would be forthcoming, that the fact that I was a former Guardian contributor, National Magazine Award winner, someone who's – you could see articles about how great I am in the Guardian, of course, and how blah, blah, blah – that I would not receive any response whatsoever after a certain point. That point was when I made it clear this was a media issue involving editors in New York. And the point at which I realized why this was happening with these people, with these two, The Guardian, was when I realized that when Luke Harding had said, oh, this guy Jonathan, whatever, he's great. He's a former New Yorker. I thought he meant a former resident of New York. I didn't realize he meant a former editor at the New Yorker, and I certainly didn't realize he meant a former editor at the New Yorker at the time when the New Yorker was so badly run that Adrian Shim was allowed to be a staff writer. Adrian Shim is a former Gawker contributor who's almost certainly has FBI ties. As I've
one of your archenemies.
One of my archenemies. Not one of the ones I would have chosen. I mean, he doesn't really rise to the stature of Peter Thiel, but he is somebody who I insist, despite how you know, despicable he might be and wormy and what have you, very indicative of something larger. And in this case, also, given his conduct in 2011, somebody that I can and have will continue to point to as a major reason why things have proceeded along the way they have, such as Palantir gaining power despite us catching them in the act, 2011. He's one of the people that made that happen in a way that becomes increasingly suspicious as one looks at it. And naturally, he's also somebody who's continued to write for the New York Times and the New Yorker and New York Magazine and The Nation and so much else, despite every single thing he's been caught lying about and caught engaging in, up to and including trying to buy stolen emails from underage British minors behind the scenes, not realizing that one of them was an FBI informant and that this would show up in Jeremy Hammond's discovery, in his criminal discovery trial, and that I would get it and that I would be less than amused by that. Anyway, that is kind of to the best I can convey the scope of it while also kind of remaining true to what's the actual specifics. That's the best I can explain what's happened here and why it is that I have once again been banned from Twitter and why it is that there will be almost no mention of this in the press whatsoever.
It leads me to wonder exactly how far have these private interests infuse themselves into the reporting process. Like, has this always been a thing that's been going on across most, quote, mainstream media? Or has this been a building process that is kind of reaching its zenith now?
Sure. So I should note that this is actually one of the things that I have been wrong about in the past. And I say that because I say that out of arrogance. I say that with the implication that I'm very rarely wrong. But of course, in this case, I used to underestimate the extent to which it was that kind of thing. Outright corruption, people paying reporters or reporters being involved with the State Department and or FBI or whatever. Or in the case of certain other people with China or cutouts for China. I know more about that now than I did even 6 months ago. And my answer is that, you know, you notice in The Godfather, if you remember the movie Godfather, there's a reference to, like, some of our reporters might like that. You know, it's always been easy to get a reporter that you can, prompt to report in something less in public interest and in something more than what is fair to your own faction. In this case, David Enrich already knows that I know this, but David Enrich has a relationship with the PR director at Deutsche Bank.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's all I'll say about that right now because we're not ready beyond that. But I've already made clear to David Enrich this, and I've already made clear to a couple of people around him that just so they can understand. I like to give people outs. I like to say, like, look, here's what will happen if you do this. You know, I don't have the time to screw with you. If you want to take this, you know, move forward, great, let's do that. But here's the actual reality of what's happening. And I will be doing this in 10 years, just like I was doing it 10 years ago, Peter Thiel, so on and so forth, circle of life, dust in the wind. In this case, you know, in general, I only know of a few people in the press, high in the press, that have illicit relationships with other entities. The most significant one, the most well-documented one, is Joseph Min, a Reuters reporter and Financial Times reporter, also a guy who gets book deals. He did a deal with H.P. Gary in early 2010, offering to sponsor his book launch for a couple $1,000s in exchange they could speak. And then a year later, Joseph Min also promotes H.P. Gary Federal CEO's Aaron Barr's claims to investigate anonymous and have this technique that he used to find the leadership and give it to the FBI. I mean, such a great, what a genius he is, blah, 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 and then went on to go after me. And him and I have debated on Canadian television, blah, 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 and Joseph Mann has, I mean, anyone can look and see what he's done to lie about Palantir and H.P. Derry in a way that benefits them. Anyone can see that Thomson Reuters did a deal with Palantir in late 2010 before this big Team Themis scandal that Palantir was involved in. And anyone can see that a press release for that was removed from the Thomson Reuters website shortly after the Team Themis scandal. Anyone can see any of this stuff. It's all very visible, and I put it together as well, and it doesn't matter. There is no one who is working and being and is successful in this industry is worth a damn. If they are working continually, if they are still employed, it means they are a coward at the very best. That's what it means. I say that people who are my friends in the past, I will say it to their faces. I'll say it, you know, privately, publicly. It is so true and so important that it can't not be said. But beyond that, you know, there's one of the people at the New York Times that I've been written about before. He wrote an article about me after having a conversation with Stratfor, and that can be seen in the Stratfor emails, which is what I went to prison over, or officially. Anyone can go on WikiLeaks right now and look up Damien Cave, and it will pull up the Stratfor emails. It'll pull up Damien Cave being referred to by Stratfor as their guy, their reliable guy, that they did blah, blah, blah. And anyone can see them talking about the op cartel Zeta affair that Anonymous was involved in, that I was involved in, and that I was attacked over by Adrian Chen and Damien Cave. It goes on and on. There's all these weird, you know, there's all these little, you know, fun connections that one finds and comes across. And it's what makes it so hard to kind of convey, because there's so much of it. And then of course it's impossible to get attended to, even by the quote press critics unquote, like Ben Smith, or who's at the New York Times now, of course, or by the Washington Post guy, whose name I forget now, but who's, you know, is not interested in some of the things that I provided him with, and never will be, and et cetera. It's bad. It's bad enough that I have less and less interest in going after Palantir and that kind of thing, and more interest in going after the people that have ensured that it's impossible.
The enablers. The enablers.
Yes, the enablers, the gatekeepers, the ones who are really, who ultimately, fundamentally, because they sit at the vector of information, they sit at the confluence of policy and the information that informs it, and they choose and they hit the switches, you know, sometimes doing their best, but are just incompetent, sometimes doing, you know, bidding of whatever, God knows what is going through their minds. But there they are. That's the most important thing to me increasingly. And it's a thing that I now understand. Without them being put back on their heels in a very public and very aggressive manner, nothing else could be accomplished.
So this leads me to wonder on forgive me for my novice level questions, but to what extent is the media in the United States, is the media apparatus, the institutions, the capital around it, how much of that has a unionized workforce? And from that question, I guess I'm trying to lead to, are there any institutions within the media that can push back against this trend that you can notice anyway?
The answer to number two is no. There's nothing that exists that can or will push back. There are organizations, there are groups, there's things like OCRP, or the OCCRP, the organization, you know, group we dealt with on 29 Leaks, which was this formation, this leak of financial documents from a shell company firm in London, that, you know, which as soon as we began overseeing this, immediately these people began like fighting to help to take the credit. Like it's the weirdest thing. There's no institutions that are capable of pushing back. The only institutions are the one. It's why myself and Michael Hastings were trying to build something of that sort in 2009, 2010. And it's why, you know, I've continually reverted back to that even as I depart to go do Arab Spring, you know, Arab democracy stuff, investigations, H.P. Derry. I always return to the press and the information structures because they're fundamental. But, the first question you asked, the unionization, all that, there are unions here and there. There's one in particular that was started, some years back. The person who started it was the first person, to claim outright, even before Adrian Chin did, that I had made up a kidnapping in Mexico, and then hid from me for the next 10 years. His name, I forget his name. He's club later. It didn't matter his name. He writes for Splinter now. So the unions are probably not going to be a viable mechanism for action reform. They'll be a mechanism, perhaps, they might succeed in slightly increasing how much these people who are worth nothing, how much society deems they're worth. But that's it. The only solution, there will be no internal reform. There will be no internal mechanisms to address any of this. And tens of thousands dying in New York City right in front of them will not change that. There is nothing that these people, again, they don't know this, but there is nothing, whether either the cowards or the predators among them, nothing that will convince them, hey, what we're doing is wrong. It's unhelpful and it's killing billions. And so the only vector to change this, the only possible way forward, involves, there's any number of ways to address it, so long as this is left increasingly to erratic, eccentric people like me. It's going to be something that involves a great deal of public humiliation. Basically,
it seems like we're talking about denazification at this point.
We absolutely are. It's very much what we're doing. It's very similar. It's very similar. And some of these people, I mean, there are some who you know would be very offended by that if they heard those terms, because they think themselves as you know very anti-Nazi and all that, and they're working at the Intercept and all that. They're the exact kind of people that allow these things to happen. They're the Weimar types, and there's what will be required is essentially a combative, fast evolving, aggressive, self assertive campaign that can articulate itself, articulate its necessity, and articulate why everything it does is in fact far less in terms of scope, in terms of the right to do things, far less than what the press has allotted itself, and uses the exact same means as the press. Just never uses any means that the press won't use. And this would be enough. So what I'm talking about here is that it's not hard to identify, document, and present the individual participants in this and collate them and make them available to the public, very much like I and my associates did with Project PM back in the day when we were doing this with the intelligence contracting sector and some of the Pentagon and intelligence projects that we revealed back then. We did that, you know, well enough, you know, apparently that the FBI had to crush it. And so I think the same thing will actually apply much, much more here, because in this case, individual freelancers who are just operating on, you know, to the extent that maybe they believe that they're not doing anything wrong, they believe that they're part of the solution, that belief will melt very quickly in the face of, so as soon as they lose their enablers, which is the public and other press, as soon as they lose the illusion, that sounds like a Guns N' Roses album, Use Your Illusion. As soon as they lose their illusion of that, as soon as that illusion is robbed from them, is taken from them, that will begin the process in which they grow weaker and more prone to error. And it's also it's the same process that will help to convey what it is that is happening here, and to the public, to the extent the public wants to know. And of course, anyone who banks upon, who depends upon, whose plan depends upon the public looking at a problem and saying this is a serious problem that we're responsible for, let's fix it. Anyone who depends upon that, as I used to, is a fool, as I used to be. Everything has to ultimately depend upon a vanguard of people who are willing and capable of accomplishing whatever the mission is. In this case, the mission is to individually discredit and humiliate and intimidate each individual bad actor in a way that is entirely fair, in a way that actually gives them the opportunity to respond if they'd like, explain, hey, why did you lie about this thing? Or are we wrong? Did you not lie? Is this thing and this thing also true at the same time? And would you like to right here, put your name to that and say, yes, I believe this is what I did here is correct. There's a whole process here. There's some nuance to it, but ultimately it's a matter of same thing they did to me, which except in a way that is more effective, because the things they did to me and to others that I've seen, including whistleblowers like Val here, can be undermined by showing us to be false. Whereas I never engage in anything that can't support itself. I never engage in anything that I'm not willing to defend as publicly as possible, which is very interesting to me and David Enmick, who's over here, you know, has already admitted to me in these messages, like, you know, I feel bad about this, or that was probably the wrong words, blah, blah. That's nothing I would, you know, if any situation in which I would say that, I would immediately have those words changed. I never would have written them to begin with. And again, that's the difference between me and David Enmick, aside from the fact that I am charming and talented and he is a weird guy with weird teeth, who, again, there's no front on which these people can't be defeated. There's a lot of them. They have all this infrastructure. They have the position. They are on top of this mountain. We are down below having to assault this fortress. Having a fortress to begin with is a bad idea in a lot of contexts. It means you're not mobile. It means you are stuck to a position. And it means that it's very clear when you go on lockdown and when you're afraid to address the mob below or the lone erratic adventurer below who's pointing out, I have this, this, and this, what's up? It becomes quite visible. There's a lot of ways this can go, but ultimately what I can say is that this will be increasingly evident, and luckily I have a couple of vectors by which I can probably push the ball forward quite a bit in the next year or so, first of which is my memoirs coming out in December, which it just so happens that I have the next 2 weeks to revise the ending to. And the ending will be this David Enmick Val Brokesmith thing, combined with this incident they had with the Black Socialists of America being pursued by the FBI on the first day of the coronavirus lockdown and the conversation I have with the FBI agent. This is a means of ending sort of my story thus far in the book and everything else by revisiting the two problems that we had. One was the state and its vastly inappropriate priorities and its willingness to suck the blood of the young, as they're doing in this case with this young man in up in your area, a few weeks ago, another story, as well as the complicity of the press and their involvement in that and their lack, at any rate, their lack of status as an actual solution. The fact that they can never be a solution to this. They cannot in their current form. They will always be a facilitator, either objectively or passively or actively. But in the current form, it has to be destroyed. The press has to be destroyed.
So what I'm gathering from this is we cannot destroy the master's house with the master's tools.
I'm not sure. I've never heard that phrasing before, other than the master. I mean, I know the master's house. I remember, what's his name? Jason Blair at the New York Times, who was fired for, he was caught, you know, making up nonsense and blah, blah. And then he wrote a book about the whole thing, trying to recast it as a racial deal called Burning Down My Master's House.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Come to think of it, I'd actually like to read that. I'm sure that'd be very quite amusing and grotesque. But I'm not sure. I mean, I guess the way I would phrase it, just not being conversant with how that concept might be applied these days and how it's usually applied and what the context tends to be, I would say that I would phrase it like this. We can have some degree of decency and the things that proceed from decency, or we can have a situation in which an industry that sits at the apex of information serves primarily as a means of jobs and prestige for a small number of people who come from places like Connecticut, for the most part, and should go fucking back there.
Yuppies,
yes. But yuppies to me is not enough these days. I keep searching for more vicious terms. It's always the eternal quest. But, you know, so I think that with this, I think there's such a case here, and it's so expansive. It's really just a matter of someone other than me being able to make it, and being willing to make it, which is another big part. But it's not hard. It's just so much is so clear. We have so much. I mean, we have so much on the New York Times. I mean, if I had half an hour on CNN, like if I was Ross Perot, would Ross Perot die, by the way? Is he still alive?
That's I do not question. Know. That is a good question.
I mean, frankly, I don't care, but, you know.
I mean, he's an interesting guy. if I was able to do what Ross Perot was doing in the early 90s and buying TV spots, you know, in order to present my ideas, in half an hour, if I had half an hour in front of the nation, I could take down 8 or 9 editors, bureau chiefs, and major contributors of the New York Times. And by virtue of the fact that I had to do that, in fact, virtue of what it took to do that, the entire New York Times itself, no doubt in my mind or in the mind of anyone else who's been watching this. The case is so strong, so clear. But anyway, I won't have the ability to buy that network time. What I might end up having is the ability to do that in a feature film with Alex Winter based on the memoirs that we've just begun we've been working on for the last few months, and then just yesterday began in earnest beginning the actual screenwriting of. And this will absolutely fucking go in the end of it, no matter what. That will be a condition of this movie being made. That this David Enrich stuff in the New York Times will be, you know, prison, blah, blah, FBI, great, don't care. SWAT teams, great, going to shoot, great, don't care. New York Times allowing this to happen, forcing it to happen, making it impossible for anything else to happen other than for the nation to deteriorate in a way that impacts the entire world and ensures the kleptocracy continues to expand. That will be the absolute, the real meaning of everything I do from here on, until such time as that ends. Then we go to Peter Thiel, and, you know, someone else is going to hang Peter Thiel, I think, some point. I feel like he's...
We're working on it, all right? We got like... going.
The way I want to close this out is I want to say something. I keep seeing these ads when I go on the social medias, and they're an ad that goes something like this. We need independent journalism now more than ever. So please consider donating and supporting to the New York Times. And I think to myself, the New York Times ain't independent journalism, and I would probably suggest people just buy a subscription to Teen Vogue, because Teen Vogue at this point probably does better journalism, and they're a hell of a lot more politically radical too, and they're open to questioning things. That's where we're at.
Zetter recently, I just met her for the first time a few weeks ago, and I'm much more impressed with her than I am than any single person who works at the New York Times or Intercept, because I feel like she should at least consider. I feel like if she was in the position that a lot of people are at the Intercept, they would at least consider saying, oh, wow, Sam Biddle did that with the FBI and with these FBI informants. And then he was given the Reality Winner documents right before she got caught. Wow, that's kind of weird. Maybe that should be addressed. Whereas there's not a single other person, and I'll name them. I mean, I'll name them at some point. I mean, I have in many cases already, usually when I was high, but I'll do it sober, you know, in a very systematic way. Not here because there's no point to it, but, cause I don't think we're preaching to anybody, but, you know, the receptive choir here, but, there's just, I mean, what I'm saying is you're correct. You're correct.
Who is the journalist you mentioned? I missed who you said.
I think her name is Kim Zetter. Let me make sure, but she's a Teen Vogue, and she was actually pushed to me by, the head of the Black Socialists of America. He was like, you know, a few weeks ago, we were trying to figure out, like, when I was helping them with this FBI situation, we were like, who can we get to actually acknowledge? Who would acknowledge that this is newsworthy, that the FBI is engaging in illegal and bizarre tactics against a 20-year-old member of the BSA, a group endorsed by Chomsky, and that they did follow his parents around, and that we have this audio of me talking to the FBI agent and him saying things he shouldn't. Everyone who talks to me says things they shouldn't. You know, no one should ever say anything to me. But, who would see this and note and think, you know what, this might be newsworthy? And of course, we had to think very hard to figure out who the fuck that would be. And he mentioned to me this person I'd never heard of. Her name is it Kim? Yeah, was it Kim?
Is it Kim Kelly?
Oh, sorry, Kim Kelly, not Kim Zetter.
Kim Kelly's the bomb. She's we have a similar taste in music, Kim and I. She's a metalhead. So yeah, Kim
That's
Kelly.
That's what she told me, that she was into metal. And she wasn't able to get the editorial interest there, but she tried, which is a million times more than I'm used to seeing happen. Absolutely, you're right. You are absolutely correct. There's no point to go in the New York Times or anything except for, hey, maybe there's a book deal in this for one of you, or hey, this will make it look like you're a real, you know, you're up against Trump and that you're in the White Rose Society or some such in the fucking 30s. You think you look like a real hero or something like that. Anything about like, hey, this is actually important. It was a case 10 years ago when I tried to get them, when I tried to give away stories, like Romas Coyne, the things I'm now known for that I end up writing myself. It was the case then, it's the case now. Even without this malice, even without this disgusting excesses, even if it just sat there not understanding what's relevant, it would still be worth destroying because it is sitting there now occupying a place in our civilization that cannot be just occupied by dead weight. It cannot. And when it's worse than dead weight, when it's run through with, you know, the sociopaths that are able to manipulate the situation, or the psychopaths rather. I'm trying to be more. My girlfriend is getting her thesis in this forensic psychology stuff. So I've been learning about this, and it's been sadly instructive about some of the people I've dealt with in the press. The fact that these books on psychopaths, very very disturbing. Anyway, even were it just incompetent, even were it populated by robots with no emotions, no ambitions, but the robots were badly programmed and thought that the best thing for our country right now was that Biden has an X problem, but it's not what you think. You know, it would still be worth, I think, eventually resorting to terrorism in those circumstances. So you can probably imagine what my stance is given how much worse things actually are. So there you go.
Well, hey, Barrett Brown, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I always enjoy the conversations with you. Real quick, since you're suspended from Twitter, how can my listeners keep up with you now that you've been suspended? And also, if you want, any final words that you have to share with David Enrich in case someone passes this along to him?
Oh, I'm still texting David Enrich pretty daily, usually with threats and talk. So which is just like I do with it. And I pointed out to him. In fact, I'll read you what I said to him. So the answer to your first question, while I'm pulling this up, is that there is nowhere really your followers can follow up with me. I'm suspended from Facebook again for another 7 days, another 30-day ban. I will almost certainly be suspended from Facebook again, even assuming that ban's not extended inexplicably as it was last time. There is nowhere. So.
I thought this was America.
It is. That may be the problem.
Yeah. Thank you. Finally, someone that says it out loud.
So here's what I'll leave your listeners with. Here's what I'll do. But again, I'm done with the ongoing like real time public stuff. There's no point to it unless it's a book or a movie or some other like massive bomb casing in which to put the munitions. It's just not worth doing. Aside from that, then we have the normal tactics of organized crime and political terrorism for 150 years to draw upon. But you know, I don't even really bother anymore going to reporters and saying, hey, this horrible thing happened. It might be important. It's just a waste of time. Here's what I told David Enrich early 18 hours ago. Talk to Adrian Chin, Joseph Min, or Peter Thiel if you're curious as to how long I'm willing to pursue someone I catch doing the sort of thing you've done. Or Robert Stacey McCain, I believe I started on him in 2007 or so. Robert Stacey McCain is a former Washington Times editor and neo-Confederate white nationalist.
I'm not a fan of Stacey McCain, and I know of his writing very well. So.
He's got 30 articles on me at the thing, and he also dealt with the FBI against me. He's admitted that, actually. It's kind of weird. And the FBI informants. Anyway, so that's what I told him. And, I'll just add this. Here's what I told Adrian Chin last night. I had never actually sent Adrian Chin a message on the phone before. Just now got around to it. I was thinking about the New York Times, and I saw that he had recently put in another article for the New York Times. They're still publishing his stuff, despite what is clearly known about him. And what I said was, looking forward to the next 9 years of warfare. This is our 9-year anniversary of being enemies, you see. Just remember that there's a difference between cruelty and ruthlessness. I'm letting him interpret what that means.
Well, hey, Barrett, thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, and may the blood flow across the ocean and into our hearts and drown wicked in its lovely flow.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Barrett Brown. Whatever you may think of him, he's got a lot to say and he sure knows how to say it. And I believe he is worth listening to. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Barrett is always a pleasure to speak with. He is most certainly never boring. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod at
protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. I believe we are getting ready to do a very festive 420 episode where we will be doing an audio commentary for the full moon feature Evil Bong, starring the one and only Tommy Chong. Also, I have a audio commentary we did coming up of the movie Corona Zombies, also available on Full Moon Features. Yes, there is already a movie about coronavirus and zombies, courtesy of Full Moon. They know how to spot an opportunity. So, thank God for Charles Band. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.